Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and welcome to the 2014 Edward Said London Lecture. I'd first like to thank the British Museum for hosting us this year, once again, particularly Neil McGregor and Joanna Michael, for their unfailing support over the years. This lecture series is now in its fifth year, and I think it's safe to say that it has firmly established itself in the cultural and political calendar of London, which is very busy, as you know. This has in great part been due to the high quality of our speakers, but also to the support of our co-sponsors, the London Review of Books, and especially the efforts of our distinguished co-organizers, Professor Jacqueline Rose, Mary Kay Wilmers, Ahedaf Suwaif, and Mariam Said. Tonight's speaker is a lawyer and award-winning writer, a co-founder of Al-Haq, a legal organization set up to fight the Israeli occupation through international human rights law. Rajash Hadi has more recently become better known as a gifted writer of non-fiction. Winner of the 2008 Orwell Prize for Palestinian Walks, Notes on a Vanishing Landscape, his writing is economical yet uncannily complex. It has an ability to deftly describe contemporary history and politics while taking the reader on delectable, though often painful, visual journeys across his beloved Palestinian landscape, or indeed back in time through the personal and collective histories of its people, including Raja's own family. With the recent publication of Strangers in the House in Danish, his books have now been translated to 15 different languages, and the lecture tonight will be published first by the London Review of Books, and then early next year in an expanded version by Profile Books. So I hope you'll look out for that. Occupation Diaries, his most recent book, has been described by The Guardian as written by a contemplative man who writes with great simplicity and beauty. Given that tonight's lecture is being held here at the British Museum, Raja has asked me to mention that he is proud to have recently been appointed legal counsel for the nascent Palestinian Museum, which is currently being established on the hills of Bir Zeit in the occupied territories. As a member of the team working on this exciting project, I can assure you that we feel extremely privileged and honored to have him on our side. Ladies and gentlemen, Rajash Hadi.
Thank you, Omar. It is a great honor to be giving the Edward Said annual lecture. 10 years after his death, I, like many of you, can still hear his voice and think, like so many others, if only Edward Said were alive today, we need him more than ever. I have often wondered what he might have said about what is happening in Palestine today. His voice is irreplaceable. He was and continues to be an inspiring figure. My hope is to do justice to his memory by speaking as candidly as he always did about three matters that interested him greatly: culture, language, and politics. Let me start with language. On the stage of the Cultural Palace in Ramallah last June, Salim Dow, a short, thin, bespectacled Palestinian actor from Haifa, sits on a suitcase, his head shaved bald, his expression intense and sorrowful. He begins his one-man autobiographical play, Sagh Salim, Arabic for absolutely intact, by pleading with the audience to understand him. He announces that after much thought, he has decided to leave the country. But before leaving, he wants to talk. "I have so much to say, years of words," he announces. But he warns that when he starts talking, he begins to tremble. this is not a play, he says. You have come to see someone who doesn't know what to do with himself. Let me start first by telling you where I come from. I was born and grew up in the Galilean village of Al-Bani. With satire and self-deprecating humor, he recounts his life from the time he was born, a few years after the Nakba, to this day. He muses on how, as a child, he could not understand why his neighbors in the village were talked of as mutasallilin, infiltrators. As he speaks the word, his face assumes an expression of perplexity, sadness, resilience, and fatigued endurance. He is almost in tears as he asks, "These were neighbors. Their homes are in the village. How did they become outlaws who could only be mentioned in whispers?" The terribly forlorn yet obdurate expression on Salim's face as he hesitantly, almost guiltily, utters the word infiltrators is one I immediately recognized as quintessentially Palestinian. It has continued to haunt me since that performance. I was still thinking of it as I drove a few days later down to the Jordan Valley through the lunar hills between Jerusalem and Jericho. There were many road signs to recently built settlements served by roads that we Palestinians could not use. How odd, having separate roads for different groups as well as different categories of land to which different rules apply. And yet, I drive along fully aware of where I can go and where I'm forbidden from going, readily taking the circuitous routes that confound the geography of the place. It was Salim Daud's play that alerted me to what I was taking for granted. As I drove, I wondered how many more terms I have unwittingly adopted and the extent to which I have made the language of occupation and defeat my own. Let me take this opportunity today to explore in the first part of this lecture how some of these terms have become so deeply ingrained in our consciousness that we stopped thinking about them. In the second part, we will look at what I call the legal narrative of the two protagonists, Israeli and Palestinian, and how and why that of the Israeli dominated. In the last part, I will conclude by describing what it would take for a vocabulary of peace to develop. Only a few of the Palestinians forced out of their homes by Israel in 1948 were bold enough to try to infiltrate back to the homes they left. Most decided to stay outside until the hostilities ended. They were given tents and provisions to help them survive. And here is our first twist of terminology. The Palestinians who were forced out of their homes and country were not defined by the United Nations as refugees with the full rights accorded to this category the world over. To have considered them as refugees would have implied that Palestine was their home to which they should be allowed to return. On both counts, this was not how the Israeli authorities saw it. They did their best to make sure the return would never happen. Rather than be placed under the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and be subject to the legal regime of international refugees established in 1951, they were accorded a special status and a specialized unit was created by the UN to take care of them. This was UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency. In so doing, only the needs of these refugees were recognized, but not their rights. The significance of this distinction remains of great importance to this day, as Israel resists the inclusion of the right of return on the agenda of the ongoing negotiations. In Israel, the property of these refugees was defined as absentee property and placed in the hands of a custodian, never to be returned or compensated, as the peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan have confirmed. And so began our long ordeal of confinement by exclusivist categorization. Palestinian refugees became a specialized category apart from the refugees the world over, and absentees a category without context, and thus denied compensation and return. Meanwhile, Arab Jews who were being absorbed into the new country of Israel were also not being called refugees. They came through Ma'borot, Hebrew for transits, as though by coming to Israel they were entering the gates of heaven and ascending to the heights. In Hebrew, they were said to be making aliyah. They were not mere immigrants to the new country. Instead, they were returning after 2,000 years of longing. A few months ago, the Israeli High Court rejected the appeal of 21 appellants who wanted their nationality to be listed as Israeli rather than Jewish in the population registry. Palestinians, who are often accused of denying the existence of Israel, find a strange ally with the High Court. Then there were also the internal absentees, as well as the internal infiltrators. These were Palestinians who never left Palestine. They only temporarily moved away from their village to stay in another part of Palestine that became Israel. But when they tried to return to their villages, they were prevented from doing so. This prohibition continues to this day. Amongst these was the poet Taha Muhammad Ali from the village of Safariyye. He did not leave Palestine, yet still could not return to his village and ended up living in nearby Nazareth. In spring and summer, he and his fellow villagers would steal into their land to surreptitiously pick wild herbs, prompting him to write, "This land denies, cheats, and betrays us. We're too much for it. It grumbles about us, detests us. Its newcomers, sailors and usurpers, uproot the backyard gardens, burying the trees. They keep us from looking too long at the anemone blossoms and cyclamen and won't allow us to touch the herbs and wild artichoke and chicory." So, already by 1948, we have three groups of Palestinians: those who are now Israeli citizens, those in Jordan who are Jordanian citizens, and those who are stateless, UNRWA, registered refugees in Arab countries or scattered elsewhere in the world. More fragmentation and differentiation was yet to come, ultimately making a mosaic of the Palestinian people. Sometimes we, the Palestinians of 48 and those like me of 67, come together when, in the eyes of Israel's foreign minister, Naftali Bennett, speaking about us in his World of Greater Israel, we are likened to shrapnel in Israel's butt. Returning to Salim Dao and his fellow villagers, they knew that if you have become a citizen of the new state, you had to celebrate its Independence Day. Otherwise, you will be viewed with suspicion. Like all other Palestinians in Israel, they were taught in school that Israeli Jews fought and won their independence from the British, thus denying both the presence and resistance of Palestinian Arabs and falsifying history by failing to acknowledge the British contribution to the creation of Israel and snugly placing Israel among nations who overcame imperialism and secured their independence from the colonizer. How odd it must have felt for those who had just lost everything to have to swallow their pride and celebrate the Independence Day of the country that had caused their Nakba. But Salim Dao has a different take. In his satirical manner, he informs us that the only day he felt free was on Israel's Independence Day. All the men prepared the picnic and got on trucks. No traffic tickets would be issued on that day. All the way to Lake Tiberias, we sang and had fun. And the best part was when we got near a police car. We cheered with great glee. Close to the water, we laid drugs on the ground, had a barbecue, sang, and danced. Every year, a few died swimming. Why not? We Arabs drown in their independence. Then in the evening, we would feel sad having to return home. Here our freedom ends. Salim raises his voice and declares, so that the freedom of others could begin, which is democracy. While Salim and the other estimated 160,000 Palestinians who managed to stay in what became Israel had to endure their strange new fate, I and the generation of Palestinians born after 1948 in the West Bank lived under Jordanian rule in almost total ignorance of what was happening in nearby Israel. My father refused to register us with UNRWA. Reluctantly, we became citizens of Jordan, which was trying its best to make us forget that we were Palestinians. But that hope of dividing Palestine between Israel and Jordan, with each absorbing as citizens those refugees who were not refugees, was foiled by Israel when in 1967 it banged on our doors and took over the West Bank from Jordan. It was hubris, the bane of all powerful countries. Until 1967, we lived with a simple tale. From my family, I heard about the heavenly Jaffa they were forced to leave. From the school curriculum, we learned the geography of historic Palestine that took no account of Israel's presence. My geography teacher, Abu al-Awad, who wore the umbaz, traditional Arab dress, would draw the map of Palestine on the blackboard. There would be the Dead Sea in the south, further north, Lake Tiberias, and above it, another small lake, Hule. We had to memorize all this, unaware that Hule was no longer there, having been drained in the early 50s, and incidentally not because of the malaria-bearing mosquitoes. We also sang, as we still do to this day, of Laban al-Jamusi, the milk of the water buffalo, that once lived in Hule, and that now has become extinct, just like Hule itself and the way of life of the marsh Arabs who had been living there. Today, Israel has created a mini Hule as a national park with a few imported water buffaloes forlornly scattered in the mini marsh. Soon afterwards began our education about Israeli ways. We could have had a head start had we been willing to listen to our fellow Palestinians who had been through it all earlier. None of the tactics Israel used to control us were new. The military government that ruled over the Palestinians who were granted Israeli citizenship in 1948 had been dissolved only 6 months before the next one began in the occupied territories of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Israel used the old tactics, and even the same personnel who were in charge of the first round. I remember one relative from Haifa who had stayed in Palestine and became an Israeli citizen, telling my father how it was going to be and what we should expect. He began by assuring us that now you are in the honeymoon period, but he said it will be a short honeymoon. Afterwards, the hardships will begin. First, they will impose heavy taxes. Then land acquisition would start. Then what is left of the land would be rendered out of reach through land use planning. As we later found out, this was exactly how it happened. But we were not prepared to listen and take precautions, for we considered those who stayed the lackeys of the enemy and the defeated who were lorded over by their Israeli masters. No, neither they nor we were glamorous. All the glamour went to those who held the gun and fought like men. not to those who practiced sumud, who endured and persevered. That we, in turn, will not be listened to, I learned later when I joined the 1991 negotiations in Washington between Israel and the PLO, but more of this later. After the 1967 war, Israel spread the word that the occupation of Palestinian land was the most benevolent in history. Still, the ungrateful Palestinians did not take it lying down. Those who resisted the occupation were called fida'iyin. Israel's word for them was muharribin. I've always wondered about this word. It's what you call a naughty child in Arabic. Anta muharrib, you are a spoiler. But what I wondered, were we spoiling? Then I realized that Israel was putting things in order for us and for them, and we were spoiling it. This was it. It took some time before we were upgraded. Eventually, when U.S. President George Bush declared the war on terror, we graduated into being called Irhabiyin, terrorists. Each and every one of us, without exception, in Israel's eyes, we are all potential terrorists. In fact, we Palestinians are all there by permission from the Israeli state. Those who carry a Palestinian passport are no different. The number on that passport remains the one assigned us by Israel and recorded in their security files and databases. Israel can at its whim prohibit anyone from returning home by revoking their residency. This is the state of all Palestinians now living in the Palestinian territories and East Jerusalem. We are all infiltrators, living there, living where we are not supposed to live. But it's much worse for Ihab Ahmad Sawalha, a young man from Asir al-Shamaliyyah, a village north of Nablus. When he was born, the official at the Rafidia Hospital in Nablus made a clerical error, registering his name as Irhab, terrorism. And so he remained on the Palestinian Authority identity card that was issued to him when he turned 16. With such a name, Ihab's life is hell. When Israeli soldiers see his name at checkpoints, they refuse to allow him to pass. And now that he is of working age, he cannot get permits to work in Israel. You might think Ihab's problem could be easily solved by requesting a correction of his name on the identity card issued by the Palestinian Authority. But even though the Palestinian Authority issues these cards, authorization has to come from Israel for the initial issuing and for every subsequent change made to them. So far, the Israeli authorities have refused to correct Ihab's name. So he has to endure life in the occupied territories being called terrorism. All these designations, categorizations, and prohibitions are intended primarily to keep us all on edge, to make us guilty for merely living on our land. The numerous checkpoints that make our lives so difficult and which fragment our territory serve no security purpose, as events this summer illustrate. 2 days into Eid al-Fitr, the holiday that marks the end of Ramadan last July, Israel decided to open the barriers at crossing points leading from the West Bank to East Jerusalem and the rest of Israel. Immediately, there were huge crowds making the most of this and going to Jerusalem, Jaffa, and the Galilee. Soon, some were seeing the sea for the first time. There was no need for permits, no stamping of documents or any checks, making it possible for those with an Israeli security record to go through. So much for the security argument that Israel claims makes these checkpoints necessary. In their kindness, the Israeli authorities allowed the Palestinians for 2 days during their feast to enjoy the land of which they dream before the gates were shut again. As I traveled through the Jordan Valley that day, I was thinking, that I'm no novice when it comes to looking at the land in an attempt to decipher Israeli designations, what is public, what are closed areas, and what are firing zones. I could see signs placed by the Israeli army right where the Bedouins pitched their tents and put their goats to pasture that said, "Danger, stay away, firing zone." The area I was driving past was part of the over 2 million acres of land the army already uses as training or firing zones. For over 3 decades now, I've been writing about the human rights aspects of the occupation and the illegality of the Jewish settlements. In my 1982 book, The Third Way, I described a strange visit I had at my law office in Ramallah from settlers from Ofra, a settlement situated north of Ramallah, established almost exclusively on privately owned Palestinian lands. The settlers asked me to register a company for them. When I refused, Aaron said, "Why not? We live in Ofra, you live in Ramallah. We have expertise we can offer you, just as you have expertise to offer us. Why should any of the locals refuse to do business with us? We are bringing progress to the area. We are not depriving you of anything. The more settlements, the more progress. How can that be bad for you?" Aaron did not want to understand. He has been at it since then. By 1987, the number of Mukharribin became plentiful in the occupied territories. We practically became all spoilers. We used every nonviolent means, boycott, civil disobedience, and some violent ones to show that we've had enough of occupation and will not stop our civil disobedience until it ends. The first intifada had begun. The military struggle, such as it was, had brought no results. It was the nonviolent first intifada that was waged inside the occupied territories that brought Israel to the negotiation table. In 1991, 5 years after it began, Israel was persuaded to attend the International Peace Conference in Madrid, which was followed by the negotiations in Washington between Israel and a Palestinian delegation. But the leadership outside failed to recognize the important role in the struggle which those of us living under Israeli rule had played, as I was to discover when I took part in the negotiations as legal advisor. I remember Edward Said coming especially to Washington to offer his services to the delegation, only to be refused. With the extensive media interest at the time, he could have played a crucial role in explaining to the American public what was taking place at these negotiations. What sort of leadership refuses an offer from a giant like Edward? Throughout my 1 year experience with the negotiations in Washington in 1991-92, and for some time afterwards, one question kept nagging me. How did Israel succeed in using more or less the same tactics against Palestinians and their property in 67 that they had used in 48? Why did Palestinians not learn how to foil those tactics? It was clear to me that Israel's strategy in the negotiations was to try its best to retain the almost 1,000 Israeli military orders that amended the local law and added to it, which dealt with every aspect of life in the occupied territories and organized the life and relations between the Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews living in the occupied territories. Different orders applied to the different groups living in the same land that discriminated between them in terms of allocation of land, use of natural resources, and possibilities for development and growth. After a year of desperately trying to impress on the Palestinian leadership the need for a legal strategy based on a review of these orders, instructions arrived from Tunis on 13 September 1992 that a review of the military orders would be harmful, since this would only give the orders recognition and legitimacy. When I heard this, I packed up my bags and left. After I left Washington, I remained intrigued by the difference in attitude to law between the two sides. I began to explore what I called the legal narrative of both. As I understand it, a legal narrative is how a people tell the story of their right to something using the symbolic language of law. A legal narrative is, by necessity, a constructed narrative. For it stands, for it to stand, it must have consistency and its own internal logic. It must have external reference points to which others can relate, and it must be communicable. In the occupied territories, Israel had mainly expressed its narrative in military orders, which it wanted to keep intact. As for the Palestinian leadership, their thinking on legal matters is characterized by a search for absolutes, as evident of the excessive importance they gave to the recognition of the PLO, believing that if Israel recognized the organization, they would also be recognizing its program of self-determination. It's also characterized by being abstract. It fails to consider the changing legal reality and shifting ground over which it is conducting negotiations, and fails to anticipate the legal case of the other side, making it unable to respond adequately to it. Elements of the narrative of the new period in the PLO struggle, characterized by agreeing to negotiations with Israel, can be traced to the meeting of the Palestinian National Council in Algiers on 15 November 1988, when the PLO recognized the need for an international conference whose aims would include, quote, the annulment of all measures of annexation and appropriation and the removal of settlements, unquote. But alas, they failed to devise a strategy for achieving this key goal. Instead, the 1993 Declaration of Principles and the 1995 Interim Agreement reached between Israel and the PLO provided that the military orders were to remain in force. Though it remained undeclared, what was in fact being preserved was a system of apartheid. The different approaches of the two sides to law cannot alone explain the dismal failure of the PLO in conducting negotiations with Israel. It was also because the leadership outside the occupied territories did not recognize or understand the nature of the struggle of those of us living under Israeli rule, just as we had failed to understand the struggle of Salim Dau and those who stayed in Israel after 1948. I wonder where the reports of Ilhaq, the Palestinian affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists, for example, ever accorded serious consideration by the leadership outside of the occupied territories. Did they take note of our study of Israel's illegal road plan number 50 of 1984? This was a comprehensive reorganization of roads in the West Bank aiming to link Israeli settlements already built or planned to each other and to Israel, bypassing Palestinian towns and villages, which has now been fully implemented by Israel. It was at this time that I began noticing how the Israeli settlers were taking care to plant trees, plan their settlements, and landscape their surroundings, not at all as though these were temporary establishments. The effect is evident today. The Israelis have organized their presence on our land for their own use and enjoyment in the best possible manner. They also encourage their students to hike in the land and get to know it. Nothing comparable was encouraged by our leaders. Now, Israeli children know our land with the Hebrew names that they have given to different sites better than most Palestinians know it. When PLO leaders first returned after the Oslo Accords were signed, many of them were shocked by the presence and nature of the Jewish settlements, their surprise betraying their failure to comprehend. This had terrible consequences. For example, the occupied West Bank included a good part of the Dead Sea, which has extremely important benefits for tourism and mineral extraction. But the Oslo deal that was reached severed the connection between this important body of water and the Palestinians, who have had no access to it for the past 20 years. It might be said that 20 years after they were signed, the Oslo Accords are now part of history. The harm they did to the cause of peace has become well known. But the difference between the two sides in their approach to law and politics that led to the disastrous deal in Oslo persists in the case of Jerusalem. Throughout the Accords, Israel was careful to keep Jerusalem out of the negotiations. As a result, the Palestinian Authority has never exercised any authority over that city. After the 1967 war, Israel annexed East Jerusalem and environs without once using the word annexation. To oppose this annexation, the Palestinian and Jordanian leadership ordered the Palestinian residents of the city to boycott municipal elections. There's no doubt that Israel's unilateral annexation by another name was illegal under international law, and that by voting in the municipal elections, the Palestinian population of the city could be seen as legitimizing this illegal action. Almost half a century later, the boycott has never been reevaluated, and the Jerusalem Palestinians have been left hostage to full Israeli rule even when they constitute 39% of the total population of Jerusalem. By not allowing them to vote in municipal forums, Israel was given the greatest gift, free of charge. They are left paying heavy taxes to the Israeli municipality while having no voice and no representation. Not surprisingly, the discrimination against them is immense, whether in infrastructure, education, municipal services, or economic prospects. The PLO had no vision in countering Israeli actions over Jerusalem by empowering the substantial Palestinian presence in the city, blinded by fear of losing the reins of power. It was, and continues to be, willing to sacrifice the welfare of some 372,000 Palestinians. After 44 years of Israeli rule, Jerusalem has become a city organized, run, and designed for the sole benefit and prosperity of its Israeli residents, particularly settlers in and around Arab East Jerusalem, with a small place, a ghetto of sorts, left for the disenfranchised Palestinian residents. The case of Jerusalem, as a demonstration of the inability of Palestinians to devise practical solutions through legal mechanisms, stands in stark opposition to Israeli tactics. Israel never declared that it was annexing the West Bank. And yet, to all intents and purposes, it has done exactly that. Contrast this with the Palestinian struggle to win nominal recognition at the UN for the State of Palestine in 2012, when the Palestinian Authority has no sovereignty over any part of Palestine and no control over the borders. This illustrates the two ways of struggle: Israel's from below by administrative actions and means, and the PLO's by abstract formulae that have a strong ring but are almost empty of meaning. Sometimes the Palestinian struggle to entrench the nominal, virtual acquisition of a state continues in physical terms, such as the current construction in Ramallah of $1 million presidential palace for visiting heads of state who come to pay homage to the putative head of a state yet to be born. After the Oslo deal was signed, I spent time writing about the different approaches to law of the two peoples. In 1997, I published From Occupation to Interim Accords, Viewing and Analyzing the Oslo Accords in a Legal Context. Edward Said contributed the foreword in a review of the book published in El Hayat newspaper. He described what I was doing as a post-mortem. The die was cast. It was too late. My experience of working with the leadership had taught me that there was no role for a legal advisor or indeed legal strategies in the way that Palestinian politics was conducted. The role of the intellectual had changed, as had the human rights activist. Now that the Oslo Accords had restructured the occupation, it was no longer possible to sustain the belief that occupation can be brought to an end by documenting the violations of the occupier and exposing their effect on the protected population suffering under a brutal occupation. Legal remedies for resisting the occupation also became subject to political negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. The PA's heavy dependence on Israel has meant that Israeli pressure can succeed in deterring the PA, for example, from joining the International Criminal Court and holding Israeli officials liable for the crimes they committed against the Palestinian people. Instead of liberation, we have ended with a quasi-state where all powers were concentrated in one man, the very same man who negotiated and signed the Oslo deal. And yet, after accepting the defeat and documenting how it came about, there was no respite, rather an unsettling continuity in the experience of those who have been following the Israeli settlement methods. Perhaps there can never be any respite under occupation. Last summer, I saw the name of an Israeli lawyer I had encountered professionally years ago in a report of a land case. In the cases I was defending, he pleaded before the military court, land court, that any land with a certain weed called netish growing on it that remained untended was therefore public land. From the recent report, I realized that he was still employing the same legal tactics to confiscate Palestinian land and still getting the same level of assistance from the Israeli civil administration that he was getting before the Oslo Accords. The similarities with those earlier cases I was involved with was staggering. They included the use of fake documents in the name of a settler-created company called no other than Al-Watan, Arabic for the nation, to register land near the illegal settlement of Afra, bypassing a law that only a local company can buy land in the territory. The Palestinian owner of the land in question had built a two-story house on his land in 1988. In 2003, this family came home one evening to discover that the locks of their house had been changed, and that a Torah institute specializing in religion and finance had moved in. Both their house and the land around it were taken, and a new fence put up with guard dogs to prevent them from even approaching it. It took 10 years for the district court in Jerusalem to decide that the land sale was forged. 10 days after this court ruling, the head of the central command in the Israeli army signed an order appropriating the house. After the family's victory in the case, their lawyer quipped, "It took the family 10 years of legal battles to win the case, but it is still unable to reach the promised land." The case had all the elements from the distant past: civil administration helping the settlers, a collaborator recruited to carry out illegal practices, and the courts, both military and civilian in Israel showing bias and failing to assist the Arab claimant. Only this time, all of this was taking place under the nose of the Palestinian Authority that has dismally failed in protecting the Palestinian family against the illegal practices of the Jewish settlers. I was reminded of the words of Aharon, the settler from Ophrah. Why? We are not depriving you of anything. The more settlements, the more progress. How can that be bad for you? Driving down to the Jordan Valley, one can see the annexation wall Israel is building, most of which is erected inside the Palestinian territory. The site of the wall around expanded Jerusalem brought to mind the documentary film Infiltrators, directed by the Palestinian artist Khaled Jarrar. This film is about other kinds of infiltrators, Palestinians infiltrating into their own territory, climbing over an 8-meter-high wall to cross from one part of the West Bank into another to get to work, to pray, or visit relatives. It was painful to see. The Qasabi Theater in Ramallah, where it was playing, was full. Many of the viewers were middle-class people who, for one reason or another, either they had money to spend in Israel or they were doing business with Israelis, could get permits to travel to Jerusalem without the hassle and danger of having to infiltrate. And there we all sat watching without shedding a tear for our destitute fellow Palestinians, mainly workers, seeking jobs, who had to go through the hazards and humiliation of climbing over that detestable wall. Was it voyeurism? What sort of people have we become to sit so passively viewing a film about our people's suffering that was devoid of redemption or relief? What has become of us? We sublimate our suffering into art. While culture flourishes, we show every sign of having given up on politics. Is this healthy? Pondering these questions, I continued my drive along the serpentine wall that curved and meandered, swerving around Israeli settlements. As I drove through this altered landscape, my mind turned to the past, to the end of 1980s and the solidarity of the First Intifada, when if one sector, say taxi drivers, was punished or deprived of their rights, others would stand by them. With Oslo, much of that solidarity and the dream of an equitable society on which we hoped to build our state has vanished and is hardly remembered, despite the valiant efforts of some to recreate it. The discrimination created by the Oslo Accords between the privileged and the non-privileged was legislated in the interim agreement of 1995 between Israel and the PLO, where incredibly an entire section was devoted to describing the different categories of VIPs and the privileges each would enjoy, all of them to be granted or withheld by Israel depending on how our esteemed leaders behaved. A photographer friend of mine, Bassam El-Mohor, has a project for a photo book. He walked up and down Ramallah's main street, his camera against his thigh, taking photographs of people passing by. He then did the same in Jaffa Road, in West Jerusalem, a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. When he looked at both sets of photographs, he was struck by how similar the two people were. You could hardly tell Arab from Jew, he told me. Not only are the faces similar, so are the languages of the two groups, Arabic and Hebrew. And yet, according to the Israeli columnist Yossi Klein, quote, being raised on a certain image of the Arab did something to us. Today it is hard to find Arabic speakers in Israel who are not Arabs, or who were bo- not born in a Muslim country. 90% of the Arabs in Israel speak Hebrew, while only 3% of the Israeli-born Jews speak Arabic. In 2012, only some 2,000 Jewish high school students took the matriculation exam in the language of 20% of their country's residents. The teenagers who took that test in Arabic did not see it as a bridge. They saw it as a weapon. And most of them, presumably, were inducted into Unit 8200, an Israeli intelligence unit. In the summer of 1998, the Israel Museum in Jerusalem put an exhibition entitled To the East, Orientalism in the Arts in Israel. The intriguing exhibit showed the shift among Zionist immigrants from being enamored with the exotic Orient to an almost complete disregard in the post-state period. According to the curator, Yigal Zelmona, quote, the East was and remains foreign to Israelis, whether to those who wanted to touch it, become a part of it, and internalize it, or to those who wanted nothing to do with it, unquote. The fact that Salim Dow, a Palestinian actor from Haifa, could perform his play successfully in Ramallah means that Palestinians from the 1948 area are finally able to tell their story to a sympathetic and understanding audience in the Palestinian areas occupied in 67. This empathy has been fostered by the commonality of our experience as the Nakba of 1948 continues in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. This is why, in order to have peace, we need to go back to what happened in 48 and come to terms with that history, for it all started then. Neither Israelis nor Palestinians can start from 67. Those who endured occupation and those who experienced life under full Israeli rule understand Israel and Israeli ways better than those without that experience, and so can point the way to a vision of a future of living together. From Jericho in the Jordan Valley, I continued to Nazareth to visit Taha Muhammad Ali's village of Safariyeh. So small is Israel-Palestine. Along the way, I saw how the land is too interconnected to ever be divisible. Just by looking at the present reality and traveling around the country, it was easy to come to the conviction that there is no way that the physical interconnection can be severed or undone. There are too many roads, too many places of residence for both sides that are in close proximity to each other, too many old towns and cities adjacent to new ones, which are now divided by walls and sometimes merely by a fence, that cannot possibly endure. For anyone visiting this country, it quickly becomes obvious that the preservation of the present mosaic of geographical fragmentation with sour and spiteful people living side by side is simply not viable in the long term. It's only sustainable by the exercise of force, which cannot last long. Walls would have to come down along with the barriers of prejudice, anger, and hatred. And yet, in Israel-Palestine, a new language for peace has not been developed, nor is there an attempt at creating a common culture between the two sides. The negotiations that began on 14 August 2013 between Israeli and Palestinian representatives under American patronage were not attended by much enthusiasm on either side. Israel agreed to participate to avoid looking as if it was not doing anything for peace. The talks are taking place behind closed doors between two hugely unequal sides. There is no indication that these discussions will be based on international law. One of the parties, Israel, controls most aspects of Palestinian life as well as the very existence of the Palestinian Authority. Had there been a powerful third party invoking the Fourth Geneva Convention and taking seriously the enforcement mechanisms provided in that law, then Israel, as an occupier, would simply have to withdraw and reverse the consequences of its illegal occupation. But the third party observing these talks is terribly biased to one side. The proliferation of cultural output by the Palestinians, whether in Israel or in the occupied territories, and the strong response and support Palestinian performers and artists have received in various parts of Western Europe for their work, sends a clear signal of support for the Palestinian cause from civil society in these countries. Perhaps the latest EU decision to deny settlement products the privileges granted other Israeli exports is an indication that sometimes governments have to respond to the will of their people. These timid attempts by the EU to enforce international law will, in time, gain momentum, and Israel might eventually be forced to submit to international law. It should be remembered that the boycott movement in support of ending apartheid in South Africa took many years to yield results. While the most recent so-called peace talks are proceeding, Israel continues to prejudice their outcome by enlarging settlements in the West Bank. Both international and local law clearly indicate what is to be done with these implants. Why does this not happen? The simple answer is because Israel is winning, and because its people have not yet begun to pay the price for their government's policies of not seeking peace, nor have they been able to grasp that there is benefit in changing from a warlike to a peaceful stance. As long as Israel is winning, it can continue to put off any attempt by the international community to enforce these laws. The veteran Israeli journalist Gideon Levy confirms this in an article he wrote for Haaretz last July, where he writes, quote, "As long as Israelis don't pay a price for the occupation, they have no incentive to bring it to an end. As long as the arrogance and self-victimization continue among the chosen people, the most chosen in the world, always the only victims, the world's explicit stance won't change a thing." Unquote. The utter absurdity of the prevailing situation was exemplified by an incident captured on video that took place on the 8th of this month in the old city of Hebron. A Jewish settler, who from the poor Hebrew seems to have been a new arrival from the U.S., living in the heart of the Arab city of Hebron, took umbrage at the sight of a Palestinian flag flying on the roof of an Arab house. He decides to take it down, finds a ladder, climbs up to the roof of the Arab house, but Israeli soldiers have placed barbed wire on the roof for the settlers' protection. So the man gets ensnared, trapped, afraid, and breathing heavily. He scolds the Arab owner of the house, Shadi Sidr, saying, "Why are you on my roof? Why are you on my roof?" The Palestinian responds, "Why are you coming to my roof? Would I be welcome in your house?" The settler responds, "I live in Israel. This is Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. It is all mine. Why do you fly the flag? This is Hebron, not Israel. I'm not in Tel Aviv. This is Palestine," Shadi says. "What is Palestine? All this is Eretz Israel," the trapped settler announces, adding, "It's all mine, all mine." At this point, an Israeli soldier comes to the settlers' rescue. He tells Shadi that placing a flag on his house is forbidden, which is not true. The soldier can see that Israeli flags are flying on all the roofs of the houses inhabited by Israeli settlers. This is one of many daily incidents that take place in Hebron and other parts of the West Bank where Israeli settlers live next to Palestinian Arabs. What then can be done to end this conflict? I would argue that we need a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, making Israel realize that the hiatus in the application of international law will not last forever, and that it will begin to exact an economic price. On the other, encouraging it to see the benefits it can derive from making peace. Until these two realizations come about, the Israelis, who show no sign of recovering from the euphoria of victory in the detrimental war of 1967, will continue to believe what Moshe Dayan, the Minister of Defense, declared at the time, that Israel is now an empire. Why should this empire, now the sixth biggest exporter of weapons in the world, submit to international law? They will continue on their triumphant path until, as the German expression puts it, they triumph themselves to defeat. As for us Palestinians, I'm afraid that we have regressed as a nation. Now there is a resurgence of fragmented identities, whether based on faction, religion, clan, or class. The national project and its inclusive vision of Palestine has suffered an enormous blow. The PLO, for all its faults, was forging some common strands and providing a sense of purpose under a national banner. Now it is but a shadow of its former self. My late father, Aziz Shadi, was one of the first Palestinian leaders to propose a Palestinian state alongside Israel. He truly believed that not only that peace was possible, but that it would transform our region into one of the best in the world, and that the cooperation of Palestinian Arabs with Israeli Jews would bring great benefits to both people and to the region as a whole. I have continued to uphold his views and to believe that together we, Palestinians and Israelis, will find a way to live and prosper and define ourselves not in opposition to each other, but as complementary communities, enhancing each other, just like the orchestra that joins musicians from both sides, which Edward Said helped create. For the time being, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement seems to me to be a necessary tactic. I cannot exaggerate the relief I've been feeling recently from the assurance that I was neither criminal, mad, or naive when I used to call for the enforcement of international law on Israel. Recently, European banks have been justifying the withdrawal of their investments from Israel due to corporate accountability rules and because of a recommendation from the Council of Ethics to exclude the Israeli companies, quote, due to contribution to serious violations of individual rights in war or conflict through the construction of settlements in East Jerusalem, unquote. These investments have been going on for close to half a century. Fundamentally, the relevant international law relative to occupation has not changed. Where was this Council of Ethics? And how come Europe only now has discovered that Israel is violating the law? It is fortunate that we Palestinians are resilient. If this belated adherence to international law continues, Prime Minister Netanyahu would be proven to have been overconfident when he declared last February that world demand for Israeli high-tech know-how would enable Israel to outflank the boycott. But the boycott is a means, not an end. The end that we should be seeking is one of sharing, not one where anger and hatred fuel exclusion, partition, and separation. After the boycott does its work and Israel as the aggressor continues, comes to its senses and begins to apply the law, then the question of the political outcome, whether one state, two states, or a confederation with the other states in the region, should be resolved by referendum. Once people's rights are recognized, their imagination will be released, and the future begins to take shape according to what people, what would bring the greatest benefit and happiness to all involved. One important point. We who have suffered the difficult past should not be allowed to prejudice the future of the new generations. The young on both sides, Israeli and Palestinian, will rightly insist that the future is theirs. They don't want that future to be determined by the dismal past that we have endured. In 1993, I realized how quickly things can change when I heard what young Palestinians were saying. Just before the Oslo deal was signed, they swore that they would fight Israel to the last day of their lives. But once the deal was signed and began to offer a small glimmer of hope, they were willing to change. You heard them say, "Yikhrib bayt al-hajar," damn stones. When reminded of their earlier position, they responded, "But we want to have a better future. We want to try to live in peace with the Israelis." Prominent amongst those who went through a complete transformation and put their faith entirely in the peace process was the Fatah leader, Mirwan Barghouti, who is now serving several life sentences in an Israeli jail for allegedly leading attacks against Israelis. Not only is it possible to hold the coming generations to the values we held or were proud of during the golden time of struggle, the First Intifada. To them, we are the generation that failed. Edward Said said that the musical workshops and the West Eastern Divan Orchestra that joined musicians from both sides were among the most important things he accomplished in his life. He considered the orchestra as a powerful illustration of his ideas on humanism, the crossing of borders, equality, and the value of both a humanistic and a musical education. Edward had no illusion that the orchestra was a way of making peace, but he also knew that one day the conflict will end and there would be a need for a new vocabulary of peace. He saw the project as an experiment in learning to harness our human resources and talents in the production of something that neither side can achieve on its own. What better than an orchestra to pave the way to a harmonious future? Given that the 20-year-old peace process has only brought inequality, injustice, and violence, we need to redeem the degraded word peace. In this, Edward can serve as an inspiration. We have to start with imagining a better world before it can begin to materialize. What a beautiful image Edward Said has left us with. A future celebrated with music produced with passion, enthusiasm, and skill by musicians from both sides of the divide. Perhaps on the 10th anniversary of his death, we should all work harder to realize his vision and make a just and equal peace a reality. I have no doubt that eventually we'll get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Raja. Thank you very much.
We have 10 minutes for Q&A, which Raja has very graciously accepted to take questions. I'll take one on each side, or if there are questions. There's that lady there. Could you just wait for your microphone, for the microphone to get you?
Thank you very much for that wonderful talk, Raja. I wonder, could you tell us what do you think of the pros and cons of taking Israel to the International Criminal Court, and is the PA, the Palestinian Authority, likely to do so, do you think?
I think it is a very, very important thing to do, and I think that Israel and Israeli leaders have been completely feeling that they are above the law, and yet there is fear, because apparently when especially military leaders, officers travel, they are warned and sometimes do it as in secret so that they will not be apprehended in countries that have this kind of this possibility of taking them to court. But unfortunately, it's a highly political matter, and the PA is unable, is not free to do this. The only weapon now that they have is to say that if the negotiations do not succeed, they will use these powers in international tribunals. But, you know, they are so entirely dependent on funding from the outside and from Europe and from America that they are not free agents. And so it's not a matter of believing that it's a good thing to do. It's a question of whether they are able to do it.
Can I take a question on the other side? No? Maybe this lady.
Thank you, Raja. How would you reconcile the dichotomy of using the Israeli legal system to fight house demolitions and land appropriation and all other infringements of international law, and in so doing, kind of legitimize that legal system? Because often people say, well, by using the legal system, and even the court of appeal and etc., we are legitimizing the occupation.
We faced this dilemma very, very early on from the early 1980s at Al Haq, when we wondered whether we should use the legal system or not. And then decided that since there was that possibility, and we didn't want anyone to say there is a possibility, why don't you use it? We will use it and show and see. And we did. And we did a lot of writing about the consequences. And the consequences were always negative. We didn't get anywhere. At one point, we thought that we could exhaust the system. So in the case of land, we thought, since there are a small number of people who are involved in the courts, in the military land courts, we would simply throw at them large number of cases. But as usual, they were smart, and what they started doing was requiring so many preparations and designs and plans and expensive material that it became exorbitant and beyond many people to apply. So this idea of exhausting the system did not work. I think that so much has been written about the system and how it covers up and how futile is the Israeli High Court that without trying out these cases, that could not have been possible to do. So I suppose, in a way, you also defeat the system by trying it out. You don't necessarily just legitimize it.
Side, maybe?
Hi. What's your opinion of the breaking the impasse, the group of the Israeli and Arab businessmen that are meeting at the moment? Do you think it's a good thing?
I don't understand what's breaking
the impasse. Have you heard it? The BTI group. formed in Davos?
Oh. I believe that it's important to understand the other side, but it's not just based on failure to understand. There are objective factors. There are so many dialogue groups and people who claim that if only the two sides understood each other and loved each other and so on, there's nothing that prevents us from being close to Israeli Jews because we are so similar in so many ways, as I said in my talk. It's just that the objective factor of Israel being a colonizer and oppressor makes it impossible to get together. So remove the obstacles, and then everything, and then it will become possible. So I'm not a believer in breaking the impasse, no.
Thank you, Raja, for an excellent lecture. Now, question about the solution. I detected some inconsistency, forgive me. On the one hand, you talked about your father's view on the two-state solution and that you supported his views. You also talked about the impossibility of partitioning Palestine or dividing it and living together, this kind of thing. And then I think at another point you talk about however it turns out, it could be a two-state, it could be a one-state, it could be a confederation. Where actually do you stand? Strike me as being a bit on the fence.
Well, thank you for asking this, because I know exactly where I stand. I think a lot of work has been done on ending the occupation, and so much support has come from all over the world and better understanding about the fact that there is an occupation, because Israel has been denying that there is an occupation, of course. So a lot of work has been done on ending the occupation, and there cannot be a first step before ending the occupation. After ending the occupation, there must be a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. And that occurrence need not continue for beyond 24 hours, but it must happen. And then there can be two sovereign entities which can decide a new relationship between them. What I believe is that what people don't realize is that the day after is not going to be like the present, because the present for people to live in various parts means a lot. So it has lots of meaning, where people are, what people can do, and so on. When there are two entities deciding the relationship between them, they can decide new relationships. And then I do not believe that the fragmentation of greater historic Palestine into two states is really a viable thing, nor is the fragmentation of the Eastern Mediterranean into Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. It's all a new thing, only 100 years old, and everybody would be better off with a new relationship. But the new relationship cannot start before we go through the steps. And the first step is two states, and then we go on further to other steps. That's exactly where I stand.
The right side is decided.
I just want to add also that, it's a dream for me to have one state. But in order to have one state, you have to have the approval of the other party, namely Israel. And where would you get that approval now? And we are not winning, so we can't impose that on them. So we have to have what is possible. And what is possible is the Palestinian state first, and then move on.
Okay. That lady there, and then... And that's it, I'm afraid. Just two more questions.
Thank you very much for your lecture this evening. Can you seek any sort of comfort from the Northern Irish settlement? Because there seem to be a lot of similarities there, just from reading up on things and the history of the sort of area. Do you ever, hope that something, you might draw some conclusions or lessons from that?
I... haven't studied the Northern Ireland Agreement thoroughly, but I know a few things about it. And one of the things that I think it was done well with the Northern Ireland is that there were a role for human rights and the Human Rights Council, and that's very important, and that was lacking in the Oslo. And this lack has meant a lot, unfortunately. The other thing is that Northern Ireland is part of the EU, and Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, is part of the EU, and that makes all the difference, I think, which we don't have the advantage of. Maybe one day we will become like the EU in the region and have free movement and so on, but until then, we don't. One negative thing from the Northern Ireland came to us is Tony Blair. He thought, misguidedly, that just as in Northern Ireland, after the agreement, there was economic incentives in order to get people to be distracted by economic affairs and so on, he did the same to us and started encouraging the banks to give lots of loans, and now we are flooded with cars. The streets are just flooded with cars. Everybody, it's probably the easiest place in the world to get a loan. From the back. I'm serious. And so people have one car, two cars, three cars, and apartments and so on. And nobody is thinking about politics and resistance because they have to pay back the loans. And that was Tony Blair.
So one last question, I'm afraid, because we have to... just that gentleman there. I'm sorry.
Following up on Dr. Carmi's question about one state, two state, can you please tell us if the world thinks the 67 occupation is an occupation, it's an illegal occupation, why isn't the 47 to 49 invasion not an occupation?
Well, I think the world accepts that Israel is there to stay, and I think we should also accept that Israel is there to stay. The only problem is that it cannot stay behaving towards the Palestinians in the way that it does and denying the history and the Nakba and the compensation and the return and so on. But Israel is there to stay, and the world, I think, stands behind Israel, but not behind Israel, the colonizer of the occupied territories. So I think that we have some chance of getting an end to occupation, but Israel is there to stay, and we have to accept that fact.
Raja, thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to end it here, but it's an absolutely fascinating evening. Just want to tell you that there are some signed copies which Raja has graciously left outside if you'd like to get one of his new book and of his older books. And just to remind you to come again next year to the 2016 and 2015 lectures, which are promised to be fantastic. We are promised, although that's not absolutely confirmed, to have Daniel Barenboim and then Naomi Klein. So thank you very much.